This is the Afternoon Magazine. I'm Celeste Quinn. On the program today, we talk about the challenges facing people with Alzheimer's disease, their families, and caretakers. Some people are calling this disease an epidemic. It is a leading cause of death in the United States. It is the fourth most prevalent cause of death after heart disease, cancer, and stroke. Some 5 million people have the disease today, and that number is expected to grow in coming years as the population grows older. Two guests join us today. They are Dr. Lenore Powell and Cameron Wright. Lenore Powell is a psychotherapist. She specializes in counseling individuals affected by an illness in the family. She is the author of Alzheimer's Disease, A Guide for Families and Caregivers. Cameron Wright is the author of a novel about a man dying of Alzheimer's disease who wants to be remembered not as a diminished man, but as a whole human being. The novel, Letters for Emily, was inspired by the writings of Cameron Wright's grandfather, Harry Wright, who died in 1996. Listeners, I invite your questions and comments for our guests. Here are the telephone numbers in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Dr. Powell, yes. Mr. Wright, good afternoon. Welcome. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
It's great to be here.
I'm certain both of you have thought a good deal about what it is like to live with Alzheimer's disease, to be the person with the disease. And I'd like to ask each of you, both of you, how do you imagine it?
Well, I don't imagine it. I have spent the last 20 years treating early onset people with Alzheimer's disease, and I have had some personal experience with it myself, so I've seen it up close and personal, mm-hmm. as they say. And I think the thing that strikes me most is the terror that the person has, because they understand something is happening to them, but they really don't know what it is. And if you tell them that they're having difficulty with short-term memory or remembering whether they just ate a meal or whether they just did something, they will soon forget it. So there is little comfort in that. And there's a tremendous amount of insecurity that develops in the person because they can't trust themselves. And ultimately, they don't trust the people who are the dearest and nearest to them and the caregivers as well.
Hmm. And I think that exactly describes really what I watched my grandfather go through. For 85, he lived to be 90 years of age, and for 85 years, he was just this fabulous person, terrific grandfather. And I have memories of going, you know, really with him on about every weekend on some adventure he would take the grandkids on. And yet about the last 5 years of his life, he indeed turned into this, you know, scared, cranky, ornery, mean, contemptible old man, and it was tragic to watch happen.
Mm. Did he suffer from Alzheimer's disease?
Well, you know, he was never diagnosed with it that I'm aware of. Mm-hmm. It was also about the last year of his life where we really clued in that he was suffering from depression as well, and it was interesting in doing the research for the book to find out that the symptoms are often confused or the same as Alzheimer's, and so he was certainly suffering from that.
In reading the novel, it's quite clear that one of the main characters, Laura, does a lot of investigative reporting, and she discovers in the book that the grandfather, or Grandpa Harry, as he's called, has been suffering for depression for a long period of time, and the diagnosis of Alzheimer's is an overlay of that, and very often that does happen. It's the two are similar. The difference is that if you ask a person who's depressed, they'll be able to tell you that they feel sad, they don't feel like getting up, they sleep a lot, life is not worth living. But the person who has Alzheimer's disease cannot really tell you that they're feeling this way.
So how do you go about discovering that, and how do you treat it?
for the professional person, you have to try to make a differential diagnosis. And unfortunately, what happens all too quickly is that when caregivers explain to physicians that the person seems to mope around, doesn't seem to have any energy, or their personality is changing, they will immediately put them on an antidepressant, which is not the best thing because that exacerbates the Alzheimer's disease. It's a very tricky differential diagnosis that you have to make.
So can depression be treated in an individual with Alzheimer's disease?
Well, the way it's been treated is through drugs. But it can be treated in a person with early onset, and I've had a lot of experience with that. And I see now that there's a great deal of more emphasis on people who have early onset. What I mean by that is people who are developing Alzheimer's between 45 and 55. And when that happens, the progression of the Alzheimer's disease is much more rapid, which is unlike what happens when an older person develops Alzheimer's disease. The progression is much slower.
If you're an older person with Alzheimer's, you're likely to live how long? 8-10 years, perhaps?
You could live 20 years.
20 years, okay. Yes. And with early onset, what's the expectation?
With early onset, I don't know what the statistics are for longevity, but the demise is usually much more rapid because as with most diseases, I think when the onset is early, then the symptomatology is speeded up, and that's what happens with Alzheimer's as well.
Yeah. Your book is now available in a third edition. It was first published in 1983. Have you seen changes in attitudes about Alzheimer's disease and other memory-impairing dimensions over the last almost 20 years now?
Well, I think that people are more aware of what Alzheimer's disease is and perhaps a little bit less put off by it, but there is still a lot of attitude that they would like to be with the person, they will come and visit if they're friends, but eventually when the deterioration of the person is such that they no longer remember the people that they have been near and dear to, the people turn away, which I think is understandable, but it's very upsetting to the caregiver more than to the person with Alzheimer's.
Mm-hmm.
Caregiver has an enormous job. This is really a two-person illness, and the caregiver is there on a 24-hour a day basis, if it's a husband or wife. Sometimes they are able to get some respite if the person with Alzheimer's is able to go to a daycare program, or they might hire a professional caregiver to be at home with the person with Alzheimer's. And some of them work, most of them go to work.
There's been then, I think, if I heard you correctly, some change in attitude about this disease.
Right.
Are people then more likely today to seek treatment when they suspect they have a problem?
Well, it seems to me that some people in the early stages are taking their own responsibility, and they're more aware that they have this kind of illness and they know what the possibilities are, and they are trying to do something about it, such as perhaps the character in Cameron's book, who begins to write these wonderful letters to his granddaughter because he wants her to know that he really was a human person and not this cranky old man that we find when we open the book.
Yeah, the protagonist, Harry Whitney, he writes letters to Emily, and Emily, I guess we should tell the listeners who haven't read the book, is the granddaughter.
Yes, she's the favorite granddaughter, exactly. And, the book was actually inspired by writings of my own grandfather. During his life, he would write poetry. And, from the time we have poetry that he wrote as a child, even. And so that was kind of his his form of passing on his legacy, if you will. And a few years before his death, he compiled those poems into a big, thick book, which he then presented to the kind of the children and grandchildren to kind of leave his legacy, again, to be remembered as the person that he was and not the person he was becoming. And so that, was really the inspiration for the book.
It's really an act of affirmation, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. And it was interesting because you could watch him get frustrated at what was happening to him. And really, at the end of his life, after he passed away, it dawned on me, too, what a tragedy that we were tending to remember him as the person he'd become, the cranky old man, and not as the person who lived 85 fabulous years. And it may be a little bit of human nature, but I thought, it's tragic that we're doing that. And so that was really the inspiration for the book, is so he'd be remembered for the man he really was.
Yeah. Lenore Paul, do you have any insights into how we can keep the whole person in perspective as a disease like this progresses?
Well, I think that we have to keep looking at the person as a whole person and not just rely on the medicines that are available, although there are some drugs that are known to be given to Alzheimer's patients, but they don't cure the Alzheimer's, but they may stop or slow down, rather, the progression of the illness. But I think also you have to pay attention to the diet of the person, the kinds of things that are healthy to eat. And there are many supplements that now have, come into the forefront that are useful. The antioxidants, ECA, are extremely helpful in terms of helping the body to be in balance and function better. There's something called phosphatidylserine, which helps the brain to function. Ginkgo biloba, I think a lot of people have heard about. There are certain herbs like saffron that are helpful for the body. The person has to continue to exercise physically and to try to exercise mentally as well. And I think that's part of treating the person with Alzheimer's as a whole person and being as loving and as caring as you possibly can. I think the Alzheimer's Association has done a great deal. They have a lot of caregiver groups and groups for, I think what we do need more are groups for persons with Alzheimer's where we can teach them certain things. Some in nursing homes have what they call reality therapy orientation, but there's also dancing. You see, people tend to maintain the skills that they learned early in life. So if a person knows how to play cards and they've continued that skill throughout their life, they may be able to continue it, as they get older and develop Alzheimer's. And I think the same thing is true with dancing or playing tennis or appreciating nature. So taking a walk in a garden is extremely wonderful for people with Alzheimer's.
Mm-hmm.
And as we do that and as we express our own loving and our caregiving, that helps to humanize the person.
Yeah, and also keep, to the extent you can, keep in contact, keep in touch. I'm thinking now how important Emily is in Harry's life.
Yes, absolutely.
Cameron, you want to talk about the relationship between Emily and Harry and how important that is to both of them?
Absolutely, and really Letters for Emily is a book about relationships. I mean, there's certainly the relationship of Harry and Emily, and he identifies with her because, they're on the same level. I mean, it seems like as the symptoms, set in, that he starts to identify more on a childlike level than with the adults, than with his own children. But that's a source of frustration to him because he always wanted to identify with his children and had a hard time doing that because of maybe some of the the depressive issues or other things in his life. And so really he uses Emily, he leaves a legacy of letters or advice to her, and he means to leave it to her. I mean, that's certainly his intent, but at the same time he hopes as well that it will be, that it's for Bob and Laura and his Michelle, as his children, that they'll kind of glean from that advice as well and realize that he was, you know, wanted to be a good father. He wanted to pass these things along, and he kind of uses Emily as the conduit to do that.
Yeah, she's a bridge.
Right.
Between generations.
Exactly.
Dr. Powell, this is something that I have seen in nursing homes. When children are present, the atmosphere is so different. And they can, the children actually make it comfortable, more comfortable for parents, the older parents,
right,
and the younger parents or the children of the nursing home resident.
Probably because the children are still interested in themselves if they're very young, or if they're older and married and have families, they'll talk about the families and what's going on and what they've done. And so they bring their energy and their vitality to the person with Alzheimer's, and which is so helpful. I had one caregiver who was the daughter of her father developed Alzheimer's disease, and she, when she was growing up, he was very big disciplinarian, and she didn't have much of a relationship with him. But she wanted so much to have a relationship with him that I suggested in my therapy with her things that she could do that she with her father, like take him out for lunch or walk with him around the nursing home or bring him pictures and remind him of when he was home and she was a little girl and remind him of family life, etc. And it was so rewarding to her, and it was so rewarding in terms of the relationship that developed with her father. It was a beautiful thing to see.
Hmm. Cameron, were you able to keep a close relationship with your grandfather through to the end of his life?
Up until about the last 4 or 5 years. I mean, he did. He got to the point where it was difficult to really even talk to him. And it was hard for him, I'm sure, and it was hard for those of us around him because he was not the person that we were used to. Mm-hmm. And so you certainly did kind of feel at a loss or like there was a person there you were losing. But you know, I was in my 30s, mid-30s at the time, and so I'd certainly had a full life with him. I mean, like I say, I have fabulous memories as a child growing up of him, his personality, of the things he would do. And so, you know, I don't have any regrets in that regard. It was just certainly sad to see those symptoms affect his life at the end.
Mm.
I think a very important point that I would like to make is that caregivers have limitations, and they need to respect their own limitations. They have to keep themselves healthy and eat right and sleep right and do their own physical exercise and try to get some respite time when they can do what they want to do, whether it's go to the library or have your nails done or you know, go out and play tennis, because they rejuvenate and then they have much more patience and much more time to, I guess as the kids say, chill out. And when they come back to the person with Alzheimer's, I think that they're better prepared to take up the burdens once again.
Mm.
So I think that the caregiver needs to recognize what their limitations, including limitations of energy, limitations of finances. And there may be a time when, even though the person, you'd like to keep the person at home when it's no longer appropriate. So then making a decision for a nursing home should be taken into consideration without tremendous feelings of guilt, because you know that you did what you could.
Yeah, you've got a very nice chapter, a very important chapter in the book on guilt.
Mm-hmm.
And guilt is just one of the emotions that can come into play.
Right.
Offer us, if you would, your perspective on guilt.
Well, guilt, as Irma Bombeck said, guilt is a gift that keeps on giving. I think I mentioned that in the book. And I've also talked about conscious guilt and unconscious guilt. But, you know, if you do something consciously, if you withhold your affection from a child because you want them to behave in a certain way, you know what you're doing. But very often there are slips, and we will do things unconsciously, and that's when the true feelings will out from a psychoanalytic perspective. But from a spiritual perspective, I think that if we have done what we feel is the right thing, that is, if we have been loving and caring and we have performed the duties that we have to do with people who suffer from Alzheimer's, I think then there should not be any guilt. And if there is, it may be that we are feeling guilty about, you know, some other things, sometimes from things from the past, or about what our ideas are that are not so positive. But I think it's guilt, as I said in the book, is the root of depression and the very essence of sorrow. And I'm reading from the book now, according to Rebbe Nachman, a spiritual leader. I think that our experience of loss can be overwhelming and can create guilt that is really unnecessary. So what I've done in the book, in all of the chapters on various feelings like anger or depression, including guilt, is to give some spiritual exercises. And the one that I've given on guilt is to see yourself in a clouded spring or ocean or fountain and listen to how the water feels when it's hurt or disturbed by an alien substance. And then relate these feelings of hurt to your own feelings. And then see an area of pure water, go there and bathe, and when you open your eyes, you'll feel refreshed and hopeful. And also a way of dealing with guilt on a daily basis is to, using imagery, which is a technique that I use with both people in the early stages of Alzheimer's as well as with caregivers, is to clean a space in your mind, because when we do that, we clear away all the cobwebs and we can deal with the present. And that's the most important thing, I think, in terms of working with an Alzheimer person as a caregiver or as a professional. You deal with the present. You don't harp on the past, what they did, what they spilled. You're always present. And I think when we're always present in life, we live a much richer and fuller life.
Yeah. At the outset of your book, you say it's important to learn to detach a little bit. Learning to detach oneself, you write, from the experience of painful emotions allows you to experience the emotion and let it penetrate you fully, then let it go.
Right. In other words, I do not suggest that people not have the emotion or try to avoid that. That's not possible, and it certainly would be hurtful. But when you allow yourself to experience the emotion fully, and then, having experienced it, let it go or detach from it, then you have put something in its place, and what you usually have put in its place is loving kindness.
Cameron Wright, I want to ask you, as a result of researching and writing this book, Letters for Emily, have you felt a connection between detachment and experience? Have you come to a new understanding of illness?
Well, I certainly, and an appreciation really for in my grandfather's case, maybe a renewed appreciation for his life, and because it was easier in those last final years to kind of discount the person, if you will, you know, to kind of decide that they were just a crazy old man, and so, you know, when you can kind of, and maybe time helps do that as well, when you're able to let some time go by and then really reflect on the true person. And one of the messages of Letters for Emily is that it's so important to leave really a legacy. It's important for the older person to leave it for those who are younger, and it's important for the younger generation to really look to those who have experience in life and have kind of been there and done that, so to speak. And so really I hope people take that away from the book as well. And in my grandfather's case, it was the legacy of his poems that was able to really to cause us to then remember him as he was and not really as he became.
Now, is this something that your family has done as a result of, you know, recognizing the gift that your grandfather left?
I think the book has certainly helped them to forget some of the horrible things that he did, the inconvenient things that he did, the silly things that he did, and really kind of remember those good times. And that was one of my hopes with the book, that it would not just, be of help to readers, people I haven't met, but that my family as well would certainly read it and then reflect on, my grandfather.
I think that's a wonderful idea, and if families would take a leaf out of Grandpa Harry's book, to put together some sort of scrapbook with pictures and things that have been said and things that the person did, to have a vibrant picture of the person and present it also to the person with Alzheimer's, but also for their remembrance. So, because unfortunately, at the end of the life of an Alzheimer's person, some people, their behavior is very bizarre. They forget themselves.
My grandfather chose to use poetry. It can be in the form of letters. It can be, a video. It can be music. I mean, there are certainly many things that we can do to kind of leave that legacy and leave that record of our lives. And it doesn't just have to be through, poetry or writing.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's wonderful. My brother-in-law also has Alzheimer's, and he has started to write poetry, which he never wrote before. And he's 86 years old.
That's great.
His poems are wonderful.
Mm. My mother-in-law works, or has worked, she's very talented in an artsy, craftsy kind of way, and she's worked with people who have Alzheimer's in nursing homes, getting them to draw, and it's very interesting that she can get them to, it's like they come out, their personality reappears, or can.
Music, art. Those are wondrous ways of dealing with people, particularly when they've lost speech or when they can't really communicate.
Mm.
And I would encourage people to participate in those kinds of programs. And the more programs that we have for Alzheimer's patients of that nature, I think the finer the treatment is, and the person very often does respond. Sometimes a person who hasn't spoken for a very long time will respond just to touch. And that's why it's so important to treat the person as a whole person.
Mm. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Today we're talking about the challenges facing people with Alzheimer's disease, their families, and caretakers. We have two guests with us this afternoon, Dr. Lenore Powell, author of Alzheimer's Disease, A Guide for Families and Caregivers. Also with us this afternoon, Cameron Wright. He's the author of a novel about a man dying of Alzheimer's who wants to be remembered not as a diminished man, but as a whole human being. The novel's title, Letters for Emily. Listeners, I invite your questions and comments. Here are the telephone numbers in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455. It was reported at the end of last month that Medicare coverage has now been authorized for Alzheimer's. I don't think that this story has received wide enough coverage.
I agree with you.
It is a critical story.
Yes.
And I want to share this information with our listeners this afternoon, since we are talking about Alzheimer's disease. And we just talked about therapies and what can we do to reach out and to help people with Alzheimer's disease, their families and their caregivers. Here... Here are the top paragraphs from the story that was included in the New York Times on March 31st.
Mm-hmm.
The Bush administration, in a major change, has authorized Medicare coverage for the treatment of Alzheimer's disease, which afflicts nearly 4 million Americans and is expected to grow to epidemic proportions with the aging of the population. The new policy means that Medicare beneficiaries can no longer be denied reimbursement for the costs of mental health services, hospice care, or home health care just because they have Alzheimer's. Dr. Powell, talk with us about the significance of this new policy.
Well, it's phenomenal. I think it's been long awaited, and it's here. And what it will do is to allow people to be in treatment with counselors and mental health professionals, those who are amenable to it. And as I said, I treated over the past 20 years people who are in the early stages of Alzheimer's. And I think it will allow caregivers to have treatment as well, because they are part of the process of taking care of the Alzheimer's patients. I think it's phenomenal, and I look forward to there being not a lot of red tape involved or a lot of paperwork involved in applying for this.
Yeah. The story continues. I just wanted to share one more paragraph and then ask another question, and then we've got a listener waiting to talk with us. In the past, many claims were automatically denied on the assumption that treatment was futile because people with Alzheimer's were incapable of any medical improvement. Now, federal officials say new studies show that people with Alzheimer's can often benefit from psychotherapy, physical and occupational therapy, and other services.
It has to do with quality of life.
Mm-hmm.
That you can improve the quality of life of the Alzheimer's patient. And so then that makes them more livable and more lovable and certainly improves the life of the caregiver as well.
Yeah. It may allow people to remain at home longer, too?
Yes, absolutely.
Right. Let's talk with a listener. Caller in Urbana on line one. Hello.
Hi. My mother had Alzheimer's. Two things that our family did that I felt helped was my mother and father had both made decisions to leave their bodies to medical research. So when we discovered that my mother had Alzheimer's, we changed it from going to the Demonstrators Association to leaving my mother's brains to Alzheimer's research.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt that they might learn something that would help somebody else, and my mother was a nice, caring person, and it seemed that it expressed that and it would help somebody else along the line. And the other thing that was really important to me was that for her memorial service, I'm a Quaker, my brother's a Presbyterian, my mother's a Presbyterian, so we did half and half, and for the last part of the service, we asked people to share stories and memories of my mother out of the silence. And my mother was 80 when she died, and her friends were not familiar with this kind of thing, but so we called and we said, we're going to do this, and if you feel you can share something with us, we would appreciate it. And what it did was it took us away from watching her erased in front of our face to going back to the way we remembered her and the way other people knew her and the kind of person she really was and the things that she did in her life. And it just cemented those things for me and reminded me that she wasn't always horrified and confused and miserable, that she was a really nice, bright person.
That's a wonderful thing to have done. I just have a comment about autopsy. There are some religions which don't permit autopsy because the body has to be intact in order for there to be burial. But just recently, a PET scan was developed where the researcher injected a radioactive isotope into the person, a living person, which could show the tangles and the plaques in the brain. and it has to do with getting a signal, and apparently the person who showed Alzheimer's disease had a higher signal than the one who did not. So that's kind of revolutionary now, and if this indeed is, if it's not experimental, I guess at this point it still is, except there was one woman who was going to go through with this. And then this would avoid the necessity of autopsy. But I think that you did a wonderful thing.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. The caller's comments in my mind raise the issue of preparations,
mm-hmm.
of making decisions. And when a person is still able to make decisions, it's important, I think, to make decisions that you can make. What's your advice on this topic? What kinds of decisions should we think about?
Well, I had the experience once of being called to Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and it was for a television program on Alzheimer's disease. It probably was in the mid-'80s. And there was a lovely woman sitting across from me in what they call the green room, and she was there with her husband. We started to chat. She had Alzheimer's disease, but she had awareness. And what she was doing is she had 6 children. She decided that she was going to visit each of her children who lived in different states and give each one what she wanted them to have. And it had to do with personal belongings and,
mm-hmm.
I guess, photographs and a variety of personal things. And this was her way of being able to say goodbye in a loving and dignified way. And I thought that was very, very beautiful.
Yeah.
But I think that we all have to prepare ourselves in terms of having a living will and in terms of maybe what we want the burial to be like eventually, because whether you have Alzheimer's disease or not, that's something that people generally prepare for. I think that we need to be prepared for knowing what some of the things are that we may not be no longer able to do, but mostly to make the most of the present. And to live with hope.
Yeah. And to be open to that individual's wishes, I think, as well.
Absolutely, yes.
And I appreciate, injecting the word hope in there. And really that's, I think, part of the key is it doesn't hit. I mean, it is a terrible time, but it can also be a time of understanding and a time of hope. And, we just need to always keep that in mind as well.
And the hope also is in the research, because every day now you're hearing something new about Alzheimer's disease.
That's true.
What's the thinking in terms of a cure for this disease?
Well, the researchers would have to talk about that. But I think that there are so many federal programs that are funding these large hospitals. And my thought, of course, is, and I guess it's a very primitive thought, is that if they would all get together, they would be able to come up with it. But I think that they do pretty wonderful research. And there are some excellent programs for people at these hospitals. They're usually connected with some medical university. And we have to just keep at it.
Mm.
And they will come across something. For example, in familial Alzheimer's disease, which affects only about 5% of all cases of Alzheimer's, they're aware that there's a hereditary component, and this is the 45 to 55 age group. So some research has linked this disease, the familial Alzheimer's, to its defective gene. And they are not sure about the chromosome, although I've read several different reports on different chromosomes. But, I mean, if you can isolate a gene, you might be mm-hmm. able to learn to prevent it.
Cameron Wright, what are you hearing from people who've read letters from Emily?
Getting just absolutely fabulous response. Several emails every day, and people tend to, you know, relate their personal experiences. But they appreciate the fact that it's a book of hope, that it kind of causes them to reevaluate their relationships. And it's been, you know, great to receive that kind of response. Great response from men as well, which I have to tell you I didn't necessarily expect.
Uh-huh.
But a lot of men who identify with the book as well, sort of a, you know, they appreciate that kind of the Tuesdays with Maury aspect of it, if you will.
Yeah. Dr. Powell, I know you mentioned in your book Tuesdays with Maury as an important book. Are there other books you would recommend that might be helpful for families and caregivers? I know the New York Times called your book indispensable, so...
Thank you.
So that's an important book to have. But
there are many, many books that have been written on Alzheimer's in the last 20 years. When my book came out in 1983, it was the second book of its type around. But now you have many, many different personal stories. And I would encourage people to read about those personal stories. And a novel like Letters for Emily, which I think is so beautiful, is not only beautifully written, but there's a little mystery there in terms of, I won't give it away, but
it's a puzzle to solve.
The puzzle of how they find the letters. Yeah.
Yeah.
So there are a couple of books now that are being written. I think Dr. Thaddeus Rauschy, who was a career counselor from Northwestern New York, is writing a book. I'm not absolutely certain about that. And I know I saw a piece on television where there is a man who's been a gardener all his life who is writing now, as he is involved in the early onset of the disease, who is writing. So I think people just need to be aware, as well as many, many books that have been written by professionals.
Cameron Wright, besides Tuesdays with Maury, do you have another book that you would recommend?
The Notebook is a novel that touches on the subject, which, of course, was on the New York Times bestseller list for many months.
Mm-hmm.
A personal favorite. That's Nicholas Sparks is the author of that.
Very good. Well, here we'll wrap it up. I want to thank the two of you very much for talking with us this afternoon.
It's been my pleasure.
Our guests this afternoon, Lenore Powell, she's a psychotherapist, the author of Alzheimer's Disease, A Guide for Families and Caregivers. Also joining us this afternoon, Cameron Wright. He's the author of a novel, Letters for Emily, inspired by the writings of Cameron Wright's grandfather, Harry Wright, who died in 1996. The novel is about a man dying of Alzheimer's who wants to be remembered not as a diminished man, but as a whole human being. I want to thank again our guests this afternoon, Cameron Wright and Lenore Powell.